You will vividly recall this year, as COVID was ripping through India, the Australian government, fearful that it would jump ship into our ports, banned flights from India. Now, many Indians were trapped either in their country of origin or helplessly watching from Australia, hoping that elderly parents or siblings wouldn't succumb to the virus. It was a shameful treatment of what is Australia's fastest growing migrant community. And the Indian diaspora in Australia becomes larger and stronger and more prominent. And my next guest has documented its history, trying to understand how Indian migrants would mould Australian in Australia into the future. Journalist Aarti Pettigeri has penned an essay in the latest edition of that august publication, Foreign Affairs magazine. It's titled New Wave, Australia's Nation Changing the Indian Diaspora. Aarti, welcome to the program. I'm fascinated by the way you take the links between Australia and India way back to Gondwanaland.
Hi, Philip. Thanks so much for having me. Yes, we actually have an incredibly, incredibly long shared history. I think for anyone who doesn't know, Gondwanaland was a supercontinent that existed about 180 million years ago. That actually, there were about four or five supercontinents on the globe, which then eventually broke up over time into the map that we know nowadays. But Australia and India, modern day Australia and India, were actually connected up by land until Australia kind of eventually broke away. So yes, incredibly, incredibly ancient links.
Now, there is some evidence of ancient links between Australia and India. A 1999 study asserts a maternal genetic connection.
Yes, that's another thing. You know, a lot of this is still, it's not, you know, completely well documented or well known about, but there are some DNA links between Indians and Indigenous Australians, and that's actually there are also some visual, like facial similarities as well. Like if you look at Indians, the Dravidians who live in the southernmost part of India, and Australian Indigenous people, there are some, you know, apparent facial similarities.
Aarti, I was absolutely astonished on my first trip to India to observe that. It was painfully obvious that something had happened.
It is true. And then that's not the only similarity. Like you said, researchers have found these genetic links. You know, there was, you know, some maternal genetic links that were found. But also the street dogs in India, they're their own actual breed. They're called pariah dogs. They look really similar to dingoes. And then there's a particular community in central India, in Madhya Pradesh, and they produce a very distinctive form of art. It's dot art. And you look at that and you look at Indigenous Australian artwork side by side and you cannot help but to notice the incredible similarities.
Fast forward to the 1800s and South Asians were moving to Australia, most famously as camel drivers and importantly, camel owners.
Yes, so this is in the kind of the 1820s or 1830s, right through to the end of the decade, back when the interior of Australia needed transport. And, you know, before trains, there were camels, as everyone knows, and the camels came from the Indian subcontinent and the desert areas like Rajasthan. And the people who came out to drive them were, well, we call them Afghans or Ghans, which is how they were kind of colloquially known, and that's where the name the Ghan, the train, comes from. But they didn't just come from modern-day Afghanistan. They came from a whole swathe of land across from Afghanistan, modern-day Pakistan, North India, over, of course, to Bangladesh. But they were just kind of collectively known as Afghan cameleers. But it's really important to point out that they weren't just camel drivers. They were actually camel owners, which means, you know, that's a huge difference in terms of wealth and power and status, right? So they did actually have quite a bit of power and status, the camel owners. Some of them made immense fortunes in Australia, and they came here not just for economic reasons, but just for adventure. That was one of the most startling things I found out, that they just wanted to have a, you know, earn a bit of money, see a new place, and then take those experiences and go home and settle down, just like backpackers do these days.
One character you profile is Siva Singh, who hawked groceries and goods around farms in the Benalla area of Victoria in the early 1900s. Tell us about him, Siva Singh.
So there were a number of hawkers who, a lot of Indians, actually a lot of Sikhs, who were hawkers who would, you know, get their carts and horses and live in them and just spend their days and weeks driving from towns or settlements in regional Australia to the next town, hawking goods, sometimes food, but most of the time, you know, household goods or clothing. And Siva Singh was one of them. And I thought it was really important to include his story because he actually gained quite a lot of prominence and respectability in his community. He actually gained citizenship around the turn of the century, but then along came the White Australia policy, of course. And in 1915, he found himself losing his citizenship. But what is important to know about him is that he just didn't put up with it or go back to India. He actually fought it, and he took his fight all the way to the High Court. And he was successful. He got his citizenship back, and he continued on to become a fixture of the local community in and around Benalla.
Artie, this is a fabulous story, and I was entirely ignorant of it. I understand there's now a memorial to Siva Singh in Benalla.
There is, yes. And I think that's just in recognition of the incredible input he had into the development of the region.
Okay, the inflow stopped once Australia's erstwhile rulers and voters decided they wanted to keep the population white. I guess this led to a long lull in Indian migration.
Yes, there was. So there were about 7,000 Indians who were in Australia at around the time that they stopped allowing non-white migrants into Australia. But then, as we know, those kind of barriers came down bit by bit. So from the mid-1950s, some highly, highly skilled Indians were allowed into Australia, mostly under the Colombo Plan, which allowed for academics to be brought into the country. So my parents actually had some friends who came in under that program. And then, you know, the walls started coming down bit by bit. The Holt government decided to abandon the policy in the mid-1960s, but then it was Gough Whitlam who formally said, yeah, this is ended. White Australia policy is no more, in 1973. And that's when the inflows decide, you know, really picked up again once more.
You write about an early scholar who came to Australia named Jayant Barpat, who's now an adjunct research professor at the Monash Asia Institute in Melbourne. His experience tells a remarkable story.
Yeah, so he came in 1965. He already had a master's degree in organic chemistry from India. He got a scholarship to study further in Monash. And, you know, before he left India, I thought this was really funny. He would tell friends, oh, yeah, I'm going to Australia to study. And they go, Australia, they speak German there. Of course, they'd never heard of Australia. They were thinking of Austria because no one in India had actually heard of Australia. And it was all completely new. It was completely new to him too. He didn't know what to expect. He came to Australia and, you know, realised, oh my God, there are outdoor toilets. It's extremely cold. I can't get the food that I'm used to. It was a very steep learning curve, but he had such a good experience. He initially hadn't planned to stay, but then thought, yes, actually, I'm going to make my life here. And that was in the 1960s, and he's still here today. You know, he's thriving. He's got a family. They've continued to, you know, put down their roots in Australia.
You make the interesting point that when he arrived, he recalls having few problems with overt racism or hostility, and I quote, because there were so few Indians, we were a novelty.
Yeah, he said he had a really good time when he arrived here. He said, and I suppose that also points to the circles he was moving in. You know, he was highly qualified. He was living and working in a university setting. So he said there were really no problems, even though there were so few Indians, even though he actually lived with Indians at the time, though, in a kind of a house share situation. But he said we were a novelty. So everyone, you know, people are really happy to talk to them and get to know them.
Yeah.
Which might come as a surprise to a lot of people, I think.
Well, he didn't have to learn German, but he did find the Australian accent itself unintelligible.
Yes, it was completely unintelligible, completely. And, you know, Indians are used to us. They've got a certain kind of palate, which comes from eating a lot of spice, a lot of chili from a really young age. And he could not get any of those foods. So everything he ate was just incredibly bland. And all they could get was Keane's curry powder. You know, Keane's curry powder, it tastes like cardboard, right? But, you know, after a while, he grew to really love this taste of Keane's curry powder. And I thought that was really charming as well.
And does that link to his lack of ability to understand the Australian accent?
I hope not.
No. Okay, it's interesting about this novelty question. When I was a kid at East Kew Primary School, the White Australia policy was still firmly in position, and we never saw a black face or even a dark brown one, least of all, of course, an Indigenous Australian. But when a couple of Indian kids turned up at school, they were wildly popular because, once again, they were a novelty.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? When was that, in the 60s or the...
No, I'm a bit older than that. Now, Artie, your own parents weren't too far behind your aunt.
No, they weren't. So after the White Australia policy was dismantled, part of the reason for that was Australia realised it desperately needed skilled migrants. It also needed more migrants just to kind of build its population. You know, part of that was a reaction to, you know, World War II and the Korea and Vietnam wars, because they realised to fortify ourselves, we need a large population, but we also need a large population to grow our economy. So, you know, bit by bit, the walls started coming down. And then when they opened up migration to Indians, they called it the era of doctors. So they really wanted the most highly skilled migrants. And my father was trained as a doctor. He wanted to leave India for various reasons. He looked at the US, he looked at the UK. There were a lot of race riots at the time. So he just thought, oh, I don't want to bring up my family there. Then he looked at Australia and thought, well, it's a bit of an unknown quantity, but they seem to be okay. There's no race riots, at least. So, yeah, he chose Australia. It was a very, very smooth passage for him. It was a very, very easy transition. It's not like it is now.
You know, your mother? Really, what welcomed. About her?
My mother followed a few years later. So she came in 1971, and that was they got married. My mum and my dad got married in India. My dad came back to Australia, and my mum followed a few months later. And she was a teacher librarian, and she found a job almost straight away. So they sailed into Australia very smoothly, very easily.
The next wave comes after your parents' generation, and of course it's IT workers and some technocrats who arrived during the 80s.
That's right. So, again, the migration program, you know, the barriers started falling away. So they didn't just want to attract the most highly skilled level of migrants. They wanted people who would, you know, do what I mentioned earlier, grow the economy, but also put their skills to the Australian marketplace. So that was a time when a lot of people who are now small business owners and very, very successful small business owners, they came out. A lot of IT workers, I think most people equate Indian migrants and Indian migration with IT skills and IT workers. And yes, technocrats, as you mentioned.
By 2000, the Indian-born population was around 37,000. At the latest count, in June 2020, it's 721,000. That's a 20-fold increase.
It's pretty big, isn't it? It's a pretty big jump. And that's also not taking into account the fact that it's not just Indian migrants who are here, but from India, but Indians who have come from other places, Fiji or South Africa or the United Kingdom, Singapore, Malaysia, but also other communities from the Indian subcontinent. So there's a really fast-growing population of Nepalese in Australia. There's a lot of Sri Lankans. There are Pakistanis. There are Mauritians. as I actually interviewed a friend of mine who's an artist, and she said, you know, this is when you walk down the street, especially in Melbourne, where she lives, it is like a sea of brown faces. And she said, that's really profound because when we were growing up, it wasn't like that. You know, we were so used to being the only Indian face in our school or in our community or in our neighbourhood.
And yet we don't see those faces in our political life. It's quite extraordinary. You know, the Chinese Australians are pretty well represented, I would have thought, at all levels of government. But I don't see Indians.
We don't see Indians, and it's a glaring and very unfortunate omission. And I think there are a few different reasons for that. One is structural. You know, there's no kind of way to kind of formally court or lure young, up-and-coming, aspiring politicians, bring them into the system, bring them into parties and nurture them and nurture their talents and help give them a pathway in. And the second thing is cultural. You know, we're just not really raised with the expectation that we can be politicians or that there's even a place for us in the political system. We're, you know, and this kind of harks back to what our parents endured. As you and your listeners probably know, India lived under a kind of a quasi-Soviet-style economic system till 1991, when economic liberalisation happened, which meant that everyone lived in a kind of a an atmosphere of poverty. So financial security is the most important element to most, if not all, Indian migrants. So they're so focused in that, they really don't have any time or inclination towards any kind of public life, any kind of public career.
Are the Indian communities cohesive?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And that's another point that I make very strongly in the essay, that one of the biggest issues with trying to get political representation is that it's not, there's no real unity within the population, within the diaspora. You know, I always describe India as being like Europe. It's not a single country, it's not a single entity. It's a connected collection of different cultures and different linguistic groups, kind of loosely grouped together in this idea of India, and that's reflected in the diaspora. So 50 years ago when my parents came out, or 40 years ago, there were so few Indians that they all just kind of gathered together wherever they came from in the country, or, you know, whatever religion they were. But now, because there are so many, it's very easy to kind of hive off into your group, into your exact community.
Within the diaspora, are Indians religiously observant, or do they sort of tend to, does that sort of tend to dissipate?
Oh, no, they really are religiously observant, although I can't really comment because I'm not religious, so I have no real insight into that part of life.
Now, the spread of COVID might have ebbed in India, but the painful memory of the flight bans hasn't. What do you think this episode says about the relationship between Indian migrants and wider Australia?
I think there are multiple layers to this. Number one, Australia has made it very clear that India is an enormous priority for it in terms of building and bettering its bilateral relationship. It has about 4 missions in India. It's got about 50 diplomats there. It is absolutely one of its top-tier priorities. But this isn't really reflected in how it treats its Indian-born population. Now, Indians come to Australia as students, but that is the pipeline to eventual migration. So they start as students and then they, you know, they get PR status, they get jobs, they settle, and eventually they become citizens. So that's a very clear and well-known and well-articulated pipeline or pathway to migration. So when the Australian government comes out and at the start of COVID, March 2020, the Australian government said, international students, it's time for you to go home. That wasn't a reality. That wasn't an option for a lot of Indians. You know, they'd spent an absolute fortune coming here. Just, you know, getting a flight here is incredibly expensive. And they, you know, with well-settled university jobs, they couldn't really just up sticks and leave. And a lot of them didn't. But they found to their great dismay that, you know, a few things. All of their classes moved online. They lost their jobs. They lost their source of income. But they also lost a lot of support from the government, and they felt that very keenly. Another huge element is that, and I've gotten a lot of emails about this from Indian students, the points that they're, and I put this in the piece as well, they need a certain number of points, so 65 points, to be considered to for permanent residency status. They achieve those points, but then the goalposts shift and they're suddenly told, oh, now you need 100 points. So that was a very clear message that a lot of students got, that they could get their 65 points, but suddenly, oh, you need 100 points. You now have to go and enrol in these courses that have absolutely no relevance to your day job or to your preferred career. And they have expressed to me that they feel like cash cows, and they feel like they're just there to kind of prop up this ailing education sector, this ailing education industry that's, you know, happened after COVID. And it's, you know, happening in this very kind of roundabout way where their you know, desire to migrate is really linked to taking on extra quite spurious courses. So that's one thing. The other thing is that suddenly they're told, no, you can't leave the country. A lot of people had very, very sick parents or sick relatives, relatives even passed away during that Delta spike in March of this year. And they really suffered. You know, I've written about this in the essay as well. As a community, the Indian diaspora has really, really suffered throughout COVID. And to not have that recognised and acknowledged by a government that really wants to court India and court Indians, well, there's just kind of like, you know, a real mixed message there. The flip side to that, though, is that I noticed that the Australian general public seemed to really, really come out in support of Indians.
Absolutely.
In terms of the flight ban.
The Pauline Hanson history shows us the ongoing resentment is easy to stir up against Chinese Australians, but there's a great affection for Indians.
Well, I don't know where that came from because, you know, we're only 10 years out of the whole student racism incident, which I think a lot of people looked at that and thought, well, that's not how we want to be. So I was quite taken aback and really pleased to see the level of incredible support from the wider Australian public towards Indians at that time, even from the most bizarre quarters like the Andrew Bolts. But I thought that, you know, that was worth signposting and mentioning.
Look, thank you for that, Aarti Bhattacharya. Aarti's essay, New Wave, Australia's Nation-Changing Indian Diaspora, is published in the latest edition of Foreign Affairs magazine, and we've really only just touched on many of the issues that Aarti so eloquently raises.